Okay, Bez Hashem, we're going to talk about how meetings work a little bit in this unit. this call, as you heard when you got on, it's the lady's voice there says this call is now being recorded. Until I hit star 9 and then 1, it's not being recorded. So the beginning of the call is not recorded, and that's. I think that's a beautiful thing that we can have a safe place where it's not being recorded, and then you know that your voice is being recorded if you speak. So you're free to speak if you want to, and anybody can ask questions, and there can be back and forth in this meeting. It's just that I want you to know that it is being recorded. So that's up to you. The topic for today is going to be, I think, how meetings work, basically. And somebody on the call has asked a bunch of great questions on that topic. And I also, if I can, I want to try to differentiate between meetings, real meetings, and phone meetings, and focusing on one type of phone meeting in particular that we have on Guard Your Eyes called the Desperados. I will just start with... I want to start with a scenario, with a question and a scenario. There's a guy who's on this call right now who participated in the Desperados call, where we've created as safe an environment as you can create on a phone, in a phone conference, the only people who are on it are tested, determined, vetted to be safe. Even like, Trump would vet these guys and let them in the country, So the point of that is to create an environment where people will know that they are indeed safe to share the truth about themselves. And everybody else on the call is doing the same. So it's a safe environment. Because the PIN number isn't available online, and each person on has to be vetted personally by leader of the call, who, always going to be somebody who's got a bunch of years of sobriety. And it hopefully understands people a little bit. So in this case, it's me. When I'm gone, it's going to probably be somebody else, So if Mashiach doesn't come before that, because after Mashiach will be healed, I presume, from all illnesses. So the purpose of the vetting is to create a safe environment. The purpose of the call then is, now that you have a safe there's some background noise of like somebody's got these sudden like noises, clicks and beeps and things like that, some kind of electronic noises. Sounds like techno music of some kind. This is kind of nice, but not right now. what I'm going to do? I'm going to do because it's continuing. So I'm going to do a star 5 if it continues. I think that's a master mute. Unless it gets quiet. So okay, it's quiet now. So anyhow, if I do a master mute, by the way, and anybody on the call wants to comment or ask questions or anything, so that just hit star 6, it'll unmute you, and then you can share on the phone or discuss, ask questions, whatever it is that you want to do. This is an open call, unlike the Desperados call. This is a truly open call. There are no open SA meetings. Only sexaholics are allowed in SA meetings. Most Alcoholics Anonymous meetings are also closed calls. Just like all SA meetings are closed meetings, there's no open SA meeting. You can get the address or phone number, or what a contact number for who to call to find out exactly where the meeting is. But where SA meetings are all over the world, they're all closed meetings. The spouse of a sexaholic is not permitted in a meeting. I got to do the master mute thing. This is very distracting. Hang on a second. Okay, so you can unmute yourself if you wish by hitting star six, I believe. Anyhow, so how do meetings work and what's with the structure? So I want to start with a scenario. I was in the an American Red Cross, I think, what do they call it? I think first aid course, about 25, where the sister who happened to be giving it was experienced. You know, she had maybe 30 years or so of doing these classes on, and there were a couple of hundred people in the room, and she was giving a first aid course. And one of the things she covered was the Heimlich maneuver, which I believe the American Red Cross called the Heimlich maneuver. I'm not sure. They might have called it, the way the American Heart Association calls it, abdominal thrusts or something like that, you know, which is, some people say is anti-Semitic because the guy was Heimlich was a Jew. But anyhow, so she was teaching this thing. And she said something shocking at the time. And I stored it away in my head, not knowing how relevant it would be to recovery. She said, because I wasn't in recovery at that time. And she said, in other words, I was acting out. she said that if you're at a dinner table in a restaurant, for example, and somebody in your party, in your favorite, gets up and walks away unannounced, and just walks away, which is in an uncharacteristic way of just, without excusing themselves, without picking up a phone to their ear. On those times, and that back then there weren't cell phones, but you know, that kind of thing, or talking to somebody while they're leaving, you know, I'm going to the bathroom, I'll be right back, or I got to make a phone call from a phone booth or whatever. They don't explain anything. They get up and it's kind of weird to you, and they just walk away, headed toward like the bathroom. Follow them. Now, you know, following people into the bathroom is something that's probably not the greatest thing to say to a sexaholic crowd, but she was right because of the purpose. The purpose is like this. She said, very often people who are choking in public get up off the table, leave, and choke to death in privacy in the bathroom because they're too embarrassed to be choking in public with a whole bunch of people who know them. You know, there's all these people that are your buddies, and now you're going, you know, and like you can't even make noise, really. I was making more noise than the typical choking person makes. The person can't breathe and they're grabbing their throat. That's a very embarrassing thing. So you can sit here and say, well, that's not embarrassing. What's embarrassing about it? You know, but that's intellectualizing. The fact is that when you need to puke, the only thing that makes you not run from the room in shame before you throw up and all the vomit comes flying out of your mouth all over your shoes and stuff is the nausea is just so painful and uncomfortable that overcomes it and you'll vomit in public even. But if you knew that it was coming in 10 seconds, you would run from the room because it's extremely embarrassing to perform a bodily function that you have no power over in a public venue, especially when it's smelly and it's, you know, like vomit is, and especially when it's embarrassing because of the powerlessness in the act of throwing up. There's a powerlessness exposed where there's still that background noise came back. It's like a certain movement of the phone or a certain, like a signal sound. I don't know if you unmuted yourself. I would prefer you mute yourself back again by hitting star six. For, you know, thank you so much. Maybe it's coming from my phone and has nothing to do with anybody here. But anyhow, that's my suggestion. So let me try to focus again. So the person who's got this bodily function going on that you can't stop and is happening against your will, particularly an unpleasant looking one, that's very hard to do in public. Very difficult. It actually helps the ego to do that kind of stuff in public. I have a friend who was the chazan. This is the same story, basically. I have a friend who was a chazan. It was L'chadodi. And you know, in the last third quarter, whatever it is, of L'chadodi, there are four stanzas there which have... there are four stanzas that have a different tune to them. Okay, so he just couldn't remember like what the tune was that he wanted to use for the last four stanzas. And very often, a chazan who's not a professional chazan, like just a guy from the shul who happens to be called up, took the yomid there, will have a little moment of hesitation before starting the tune for the lechadodis at the end of the, for the last four, lechadodi lines. So there'll be a little hesitation. It might sometimes, you've been there. We've all been there. It gets a little uncomfortable. Like, does he want me to start a tune for him? And there's a temptation of some of the more forward Baal Menachem, in the group to kind of start a niggun of their own, like to kind of quote unquote help him. In the meantime, if he's trying desperately to remember the tune that he wants, that's like the worst possible thing you can do, for him is just it'll be on the tip of his tongue. He's about to get that tune and start it, which is the one he wants. And now you're going to stay, it's like, oh no, now he'll never remember the thing that he wants. And now he's basically got to do what you started. So there's always an awkward situation where people want to help and they don't know if they should. And then you get to like 3-second mark. It all happens in about 2 seconds. There's 2 seconds of silence at that point. It's very awkward. And then 3 seconds is sort of like the earthquake thing with the, what's that thing? The 0.7 magnitude earthquake. And then there's a 0.75, which is like three times bigger than a seven. 7.5 is literally, it's like twice as big or three times as big an earthquake as a seven, because the scale kind of goes, up at a very sharp angle after like, four, five, six. So you've never heard of like an eight, on the Richter scale. You never heard of an earthquake like that, usually. But anyway, So it's kind of like after 3 seconds, it's like much more awkward. 4 seconds, it's three, four, five, six times as awkward, So that's what happened with this guy. It was like 3 seconds past, 4 seconds, and he realized, I can't remember the tune, but he remembered the second half of the tune. It was a great eitan, tune. And I'd sing it now for you, but I can't remember it. Anyway, so he couldn't remember the first half of how it starts. He just remembered how it ends. So he walked off the bima just for a second to the guy sitting right next to the bima, who's a great Baal Menachem, and he says to him very quietly, mumbles to him, that tune, dee, 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 dee. How does it start? And the guy goes, da, 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 and he tells him, he sings it right away for him quietly, the beginning of the stanza. And then the guy walks back up to the bima, all this happened in about 5 seconds. He walks back up to the, the second 5 seconds. So he walks back up to the bima and he starts the tune, and we had a rousing, great ending of Lecha Dodi, last four stanzas of Lecha Dodi was Gishmak. And a few people chuckled because it was funny. What's so funny? Funny thing is, this guy has no ego. Funny thing is, this guy wasn't thinking, oh my God, I can't think of the tune. I want to dig a hole and bury myself in it right now. He wasn't thinking that. He was thinking, how am I going to solve this problem? Let me go over to that guy and ask him. Oh, people will see that I'm a dummy and I can't remember the tune. Who cares? I want us to have a nice time together. I want to sing this tune. This is a great tune. Beautiful moment. Beautiful moment to me. The opposite of it was an experience that I had where there was a big Talmid Chacham, sweet guy who I know and respect tremendously, who is a great friend of all people who are addicts. He's a great guy he's a Rav, one of the first Rabbanim I know in the community where he lives that actually encouraged 12-step groups to meet in the annex of the shul. Of their shul. So anyhow, this guy who I love happened to be the chazan for the Haftorah at some simcha or something. And this is a Haftorah where there's a really hard word in the middle of it with a bunch of vavs or something. And it's like a really weird word. Pashit clearly didn't know how to pronounce it immediately, so he stops. And then he clears his throat. He realized that he's about to say it incorrectly, and he stopped, cleared his throat again. And then he said the word correctly, and then he moved on. And I thought to myself, why is he clearing his throat? You think it's a cool, I mean, was it a coincidence that he had to clear his throat right then that he couldn't figure out how to pronounce his word? You know, it's quite a coincidence that, you know, he clearly didn't know how to pronounce the word. I didn't know how to pronounce the word either. He was, and just then he had to clear his throat. So it was perfect. He had that extra time to figure out what the word is. No, that's not what happened. I'm sorry. What happened was that he felt the same desperation of embarrassment that I would feel, that anybody would feel, except for this guy with the lepidosis, would feel standing up there and not knowing how to pronounce the word. You know, some other people who really don't have an ego would say to the person standing on the bima next to him, because in our shul and in many shuls during the Haftorah, there is a minig of having the gab, one of the, you know, the main gabbai standing up there, would say to him, you know, hey, you know, you know, how do you pronounce this word, kind of thing. Anyway, but some people would do that, but most people would not. So this guy found the perfect cover, and he cleared his throat a few times before he finally figured out the word. That's like delay for, it's kind of like delaying, you know, stalling in order to avoid embarrassment. But it was obvious that he didn't know how to pronounce the word. So, you know, that's normal. That's normal. And this person at the doing the Red Cross class was right. And I remember the reason that what she said made such an impression on me is because when I was 11 years old, I was at the Thanksgiving table. We celebrated Thanksgiving. And as many children of Jewish immigrants do. My parents used to make a sumptuous meal. And there were all these guests there, cousins that I hardly ever saw, cousins that I, you know, would see sometimes, cousins that I never saw, cousins that I couldn't stand, whatever. And there was a whole cheder there, like 30 people, 25 people, 30 people. And there I was, 11-year-old kid, you know, of course the world revolves around me. And, you know, as, you know, and I'm an addict and that's the way we think anyhow. But, and then I am sitting and I'm kind of sucking on a sucking candy that I elected to pop in my mouth a few minutes before. And I realized, I can't breathe. It slipped right down my throat and it popped right into that trachea thing. And I could not breathe a drop. And I realized suddenly I'm choking. I can't breathe. And I got up and I went straight to the bathroom and locked the door behind me, locked it behind me. And I remember looking in the mirror, desperately trying to like breathe, you know, cough, breathe, get it out, do something, you know? And I remember hitting myself instinctively, hitting my chest against the sink, trying to kick it out of there, you know? And finally I coughed and, you know, obviously I survived and I'm here today. Had I asked for help, I mean, had I just put my hand on my throat and did the universal sign of choking and stuff, people might have started annoyingly asking me things like, oh, are you okay? What's going on? Tell us. Why can't you tell us? You know, people might have been doing that. I don't know. That may have happened. But on the other hand, somebody probably would have washed it out of me, you know? And I would have been okay too, but it was highly embarrassing. Okay. That's the embarrassment of opening up about my sexaholism in a meeting. That's the embarrassment. It's the embarrassment of choking in public. It's the embarrassment of having diarrhea in public. It's the embarrassment of vomiting in public. Doing something that's not morally reprehensible, but it's embarrassing as hell because there are people there. And I'd rather go off and hide alone, even though I'm going to choke in this bathroom and possibly die, because I'd rather not die publicly. It's very embarrassing. You know, and by the way, in the halacha, this is the truth, that the halacha sfarim states specifically about kavod ames being so much more than kavod for a chai in certain respects, because of the embarrassment that if this person's aware and kind of watching their body laying there, the dead person, you know, it has some, if their ruach or their nefesh or something is floating around over there, and is aware of their body laying there, it's highly embarrassing to be laying there dead when anybody could, like I can't react, I can't do anything, I'm laying there. It's like you're sleeping and you know that people are like looking at your face and watching you. When you wake up and you see the video, you're going to be angry at those people. Why did you do that to me? Don't you see how embarrassing that was? You know? And you drool, and they see you drooling, and you're not able to control it because you're asleep. It's just, what are you doing to me? You know? And this is something you can, you know, you can hear me talk about this, and it can make no sense to you. When you're in that situation, you'll know. You're quite likely to be furious at the people. You're quite likely to run and hide from the embarrassment. So if you disagree with this and you say, nah, I'm thinking about it, I can't imagine what the problem would be. So then you're either a different kind of person or you're just in denial because you're intellectualizing, which, you know, go to the average funeral and listen to eulogies, you know? And it's like, you know, you'll listen to the intellectualizing, you know? Especially if it's that day and a firm one, God forbid, Loleno, I mean, you know, from person in this, you know, he goes, well, you know, the year Shemayim that my father taught us was just tremendous, you know, like, you know, he's dead. Do you like cry? Well, no, I don't cry in public. That's another bodily function that I can't do when people are watching. You know, the Gemara says, Agrid has paid a deluye, that the actual schar, the actual benefit, not the schar and olam haba, the benefit of a eulogy is to make people cry, and for the person giving the eulogy to cry. Where's your emotion? Are you dead? Are you a big brain? Is that the idea? You know. So, are you a safer? You know. Maybe it's safer. S-A-F-E-R. You're safer. You know, not being emotional. But anyhow. So, what is going on over there? You know, what is going on? A meeting is a place where people who have things that they would rather crawl away and die than be seen or hurt or than anybody, you know, would witness their problem, actually go and allow themselves to be witnessed having this problem, because they know that everybody else in the meeting understands exactly what it is. They've also vomited in public on a news suit in the middle of, you know, shul, right at their seat. You know, they've also done that. It's highly embarrassing. It's, why is it so embarrassing? You just suddenly vomited. It's not like you were sitting there and aiming at it. You know, it's not like you did it intentionally. Why are we so deeply embarrassed? Because of powerlessness. That's what it is. And that's all that it is. It's because I'm powerless over something that's just dirty. It's unseemly. It's embarrassing. It's unseemly. There's nothing immoral and evil about it. It's just it's just I have no power to stop this bodily function from happening. And it just goes, and there's people who see me making this kind of a noise in front of everybody. It's just so embarrassing. That's what meetings are. Going on Guard Your Eyes is telling people that I vomited. Congratulations. You know? Meetings is experiencing it and getting over it. It's getting over the shame by opening up about the reality of the experiences. That's why sharing about things, oh, Amol, I used to masturbate. You know? Amol, I used to do this. That misses. Well, then why are you here? You know, if you stopped 37 years ago, you know, why are you here? You know, well, of course, there's the guy, there are plenty of guys who will say, yeah, I used to do this. Well, when was that? It was last week, you know. And it's like, you know, the smoker thing, you know, a doctor, you know, do you smoke? No, doctor, I don't smoke. Oh, really? Did you ever smoke? Yeah, I smoked for years. And you're looking at the guy and he's like, you know, 17, you're thinking for years. You go, yeah, well, years, what, you smoked from the ages 6 to 12 or something? Like, when did you quit? And he goes, oh, this morning at 10 o'clock. And the doctor looks at the watch and it says 11:30. And he's like, okay, that's quitting? Like, what are you talking about?
You know, that's the joke, you know, kind of scenario, but that happens all the time. So, but even if it's not that way, even if it's not that way, there, if I'm coming to a meeting, then that means that I am powerless over my drug. Now, again, the guard your eyes, run of the mill, you know, rank and file guard your eyes member defined that I've spoken to and that I've read from and that I've known for the past, you know, almost 10 years on guard your eyes, defines powerless. And this is how typically, I think, I would bet even in the guard your eyes handbook, it's defined this way. I would guess if it is defined, is that we don't have the power to overcome it. Okay. You know, that is not the definition of powerless that most addicts I know use for what powerless means. You know, and I define this in my first step talk for the Guard Your Eyes, you know, recorded thing on the steps from a few years back. The basic definition of powerless has two parts. One is that, yeah, left up to my own devices, I'm going to end up drinking again eventually, you know. And so in an ultimate sense, yes, I'm not able to overcome this in an ultimate sense. But certainly I can see bottles of liquor go by, or I can see pretty, you know, porn opportunities go by once in a while and just say no and stuff. I have power of choice in the moment, you know, very often. Maybe not always, but very often. But the ichor of powerless is that when I take in my drug, when I use my drug, I change and I lose my power to judge and to control. When I start, I end up, maybe not right away, but I end up setting a cycle and a process in motion that is guaranteed to end up with me doing things that are very, very stupid, that risk my standing in the community or my standing in the family or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. If you've ever sat in your house with your kids home, with the door locked, you know, watching pornography and masturbating, then you've put your family at risk because you may have forgotten to lock the door. Your child may have a key. The door might not have been locked and you're sure that it was. And your 12-year-old daughter might walk in and then you're going to have to go, Abba had a terrible rash. I was scratching a rash, you know, with my pants down in front of a computer screen, and you slap the laptop shut, and it's a moment that you want to die. It's literally a moment you want to die. You ruined this kid. You messed up this kid. You messed up the relationship, et cetera, et cetera. And this is like, that's what we risk when we do these things, you know? We risk all kinds of stuff, and yet we do these things. So fine. Anyhow, but that's, I just gave one small example, but the examples are obviously very, very broad, and I'm not trying to give a comprehensive picture of that. But coming back to the point that I was trying to make, I lost my train of thought a little bit, but it's on mute, so no one can help me out. I started off speaking about the embarrassment of the moment and how we don't want to admit these things in public because it's like choking in public, where most of us would run to the bathroom to choke in private because it's so embarrassing, or vomiting, where none of us would want to be sitting in the thing with, you know, the shul there, and you're in your seat having a vomiting attack, and you're going, and people are actually watching you. You're powerless over that. That's what's embarrassing about it. Even though there's nothing morally reprehensible about doing that, if it came completely out of control, and you know no one's going to hate you over it, but before and after it happens, you want to die. You know, people who have epileptic seizures are the same way. Anybody who knows anybody here who's had an epileptic grand mal seizure, after the seizure's over, the person realizes what happened slowly, and a tremendous sense of shame comes over them, because they often lose sometimes they lose bowel and bladder control. They might vomit. They're shaking on the floor uncontrollably. It's one of the most embarrassing experiences you can have. What's embarrassing about it? It's because of powerlessness. That's why you don't want to admit the truth about yourself to other people. That's why I don't want to admit the truth about myself to other people. it's because of the same thing as choking or vomiting in public. It's the same exact thing. Compounded by the distraction of the immoral stuff and the shame about that. But the ichor of it really is the powerlessness, the uncontrollableness, and the fact that here I am doing something that, well, normally I'd be sitting with my chin tucked in my good posture and looking okay, you know? And here it's the opposite, and I can't stop. And would all of you please turn around? Would all of you please turn around? You know? That's the vomiting experience. That's the same thing. Same exact thing. So then the next thing I said, the next thing I spoke about was, what was it again? The powerlessness, the definition of powerlessness is not the typical, what I hear on Guard Your Eyes and what I hear in some meetings in certain places, especially where there are a lot of religious people. They misconstrue the powerless as, well, I'm powerless over it. You know, I just can't stop. I'm not responsible. Like hell you're not responsible. What are you talking about? You are responsible. Adam mu'ad la'olam. Period. You know? So addiction 12 steps is not there to say, you know, you're not responsible. It's a disease. It's really, you know, that's not the reality. So the definition of the powerlessness is that the ichor definition of the powerlessness is that once I take in my drug, I can't really successfully do it. Other people can successfully enjoy this thing. I can't successfully enjoy it. When I try to enjoy it, I end up not enjoying it after a while because I end up doing things, risking my reputation, risking my family, risking my marriage, risking my health, spending lots of money that I regret afterwards that I did, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And setting in motion a whole set of circumstances where I have to lie. The ichor to me of success and recovery is I don't have to remember anything I said yesterday because I never lie. So I don't have to remember what I said yesterday. When I was in active addiction, or I should say in present tense, when I am in active addiction, I need to remember what I said yesterday. I need to keep in mind who I'm meeting in the street so that they don't recognize me and say to my wife, oh, I was with him yesterday. You know, your husband's you know, I don't have to think in those terms. There's no nervousness. I'm not anxious about the past anymore because I'm sober and clean. Now, I know that the typical guy says, you know, and I'm not getting into the topic of telling the wife. That is an entirely separate topic, and sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, sometimes it's necessary, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's the most horrific mistake you can possibly make, and sometimes without it, you're not going to stay sober, and your marriage is going to be destroyed anyway. So there's, you know, there's pluses and minuses, and I'm not getting into that right now. That's not what this talk is about. But there are situations where the reason that he can't tell his wife, you know, somebody says, well, you know, you have to be honest with your wife about what you did, blah, blah, blah. And the guy says, oh, why do I have to tell her? But because you're a liar, because you're lying. He goes, no. I'm not going to act out from now on. So from now on, I'll be honest with her. Everybody says that. Everybody I know says that. You know, from now on, I'm gonna be honest. You know, from now on, I'm gonna tell the truth. So what do I lose by, you know, how is that not honest? I'm clean now, and I'm going to be clean for the rest of our marriage. Well, let's say you had sex with your sister-in-law, you know, or your brother-in-law, or whatever, you know, a few times. And that's going to go away. And it's like, what happens if your wife had sex with, let's say she didn't have, you know, intercourse. Let's say she, you know, was just sexual in other ways with your brother or with your chavrusa or with, you know, somebody else, you know, who's friend, who you stay friends with forever. And you stay friends with these people forever and they still come. And then after 120, you find out that they had an affair during years, you know, between years 4 and 7 of your marriage. and you never found out, they never told you. How did you feel about that? Again, you can intellectualize it and say, well, I wouldn't care. I'm an open-minded man, and I understand people make mistakes. No, no, no. Emotional hair. You're a liar. That's not true. Especially if you're still alive and you're still married. And these people are eating over at your house for Shabbos again. And it's like, oh, but we did tshuva over it many years ago. You did tshuva over it? You never told me? And now you're living, I'm living a lie. It's a little, but that was 10 years ago. But that was a year ago. But that was last month. But that was last week. And we quit this morning. It was yesterday. And we decided we're never going to do it again. Why should we tell you? There'll be a time 10 years from now when it will have been 10 years ago. Why should we tell you? In 35 years from now, we'll all be old and we'll be sitting at a table and we never told you, and why should we have told you? And that same logic works for half an hour ago in the closet, doesn't it? So there's a different level of honesty here. Meetings are about that kind of honesty, where I don't varnish anything. I don't sugarcoat anything. You know, I don't pretend that things are worse than they are, but I don't sugarcoat. I tell the truth, you know. The purpose of the Desperados call is to help those guys who are just too damn ashamed for, you know, to do that in a public setting where there are other people who are real there, who they might know, who this, who that, you know. But I can do it on the phone to real people on the phone. That's a buffer zone. It's an in-between phase. And that's what the Desperados call is, that's who the Desperados call is mainly geared for. And most of those guys graduate from the Desperados call to real live meetings. Some of them get what they need to stay sober on the Desperados call. But most of them move on to meetings voluntarily because they need that and they know it. They know that there's a certain amount of honesty that's only going to happen when I'm honest with self-honesty. That's only going to happen when I'm honest with other people, real life people, you know. There are a lot of angles to this, and I'm not going to go get distracted onto those angles. And it is 9 o'clock, so it is past 9, so I'm going to kind of tie the strings together here. What does this have to do with live meetings? How do live meetings work? And how does that, all the things that I've said until now, fit into the culture of live meetings? If you look at the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which are the same in Sexaholics Anonymous, basically, and in every other 12-step group, basically the same. We just switch drugs, you know what I mean? But the steps are basically the same. If you look at the 12 steps, you'll see that there's the 12 steps, which is a pretty rigorous, pretty simple program. It's very not complicated, very simple program that any farm boy can do. Anybody can do this 12-step program. There's no low intelligence level, you know. And a Chassidish guy, you know, who doesn't even speak English, who never heard of the word, you know, ego or self-conscious, doesn't know what that even means, you know. Like, you think, oh, he can't do these 12 steps because they're goyish. No, there's nothing goyish. These are just simple. This is Derech Eretz. It's not Torah. It's Derech Eretz. And it's Kodma LaTorah. It takes precedence over Torah. It precedes it. It takes precedence over Torah. And it's a necessity. If you want to have Torah, if you're an addict and you want to have Torah successfully, you're not going to have it without recovery. And that's what the 12 steps are for, recovery. Recovery means getting back, getting something back, recovering. Teshuva, similarly, from a religious perspective, it's parallel to Teshuva, but it's in Derech Eretz. So what are you recovering? You're getting back what we say right at the beginning of the steps. The very, very first step says, I'm basically a nutcase, and I can't even stop. I can't even fix myself. I can't spring myself from this prison. I can't get myself out of this prison. And I'm nuts. I can't manage my own life, and I'm powerless to stop this addiction because I'm going to keep trying to manage my own life using my drug. That's what I do. That's what an addict is. So what am I going to do? You know? And the second step says, okay, the answer is, came to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. You know? Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. The goal here is not sobriety. The goal here is sanity. That's the goal. Sobriety is a hechatimtza to achieve sanity. The bigger picture here is sanity. That's my goal. That is my goal in all the steps, sanity. Only in the 12th step do we say, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, of doing these steps, not thinking and reading about them, but doing them. These are the steps we took, the book says, not the steps that we thought about or understood. Understanding these steps will give you zero. You're better off not understanding them, actually. Far better off not understanding them than understanding them if you're not going to work them. So that's what the steps will give me. What? Sanity. And guess what? As a bonus, you get a spiritual experience. But that's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for sanity. That is my goal. As a result, we achieve so much more. We get a gift of so much more. Sobriety and spirituality. A relationship with my own God. That's honest. How has it become honest? Well, if you're a religious guy and you're masturbating looking at pornography, instead of like lying to yourself and blaming God for it and excusing it because you have a very big Yetzer Hara, which is just a trick, so it's just blaming it on God. Instead of doing that, it's taking self-responsibility. The 12 steps is about taking self-responsibility and making it real instead of just in a book, pretend. It's for real. This is for real. How do I make it for real? Self-honesty comes from honesty to other people. If I'm honest with other real-life people, then I'll be able to achieve self-honesty. And if I have self-honesty, then I know for the first time in my life that when I speak to God, I'm being real and I'm really speaking to my God instead of as we say in Yiddish. So anyhow, that's the opportunity that the meetings are giving people, and that's the opportunity that the steps are giving people. But the meetings aren't the steps. And people say, well, if I walk into a meeting, how do I know that what step they're up to and what am I going to work on? Well, the steps are one thing. The steps, an addict works with their sponsor. That's what a sponsor is for. A sponsor is a person who men typically are sponsored by men. Women are typically sponsored by women, especially in sex addiction fellowships for obvious reasons. The goal of a sponsor is to help the sponsee, the member, the other member, work his steps or her steps. The sponsor shares how I worked the steps with the sponsee, explicitly, clearly, and simply, and awkwardly. It's always awkward, and it's always simple and clear. Very, very simple. And the more complicated it gets, the worse it gets, the more inefficient it gets, the bigger waste of time this becomes. You know, the more complicated it is. Which character defect is it? Check off the checklist, blah, 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 blah. Is it this? But maybe it's operating this. But even though I have an underlying blah, 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 with my memory as a woman, and I was molested, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's like, oh, no. Very complex. And how does God fit in? What does God really want from me? No. That's not the steps. That's talking about the steps. That's studying the steps. Working the steps is very simple. Very, very simple. And awkward in its simplicity. So that's the steps. That's a sponsor. That's individual. The meeting is a fellowship. It's a culture. The Sefer B'nei Machshava Tova by the P.S. Etzner, Hashem Yinkom Domov, is a sefer that he wrote in order to create a chevra that is basically a 12-step group. You know, and he did this in Warsaw, where he lived, you know, P.S. Etzner. Did he live in P.S. Etzner? But anyway, this is what he was trying to establish, a place where, and he has certain rules in B'nai Machshava Tova. He writes certain rules. Among them is no crosstalk, where people don't disagree with other people's stuff. You just respect what other people say as their truth, and then you share yours, you know? In private conversations, you're allowed to comment to people, of course, but, you know, the basic thrust of the meeting is, of the group is, to share their own enlightenment with other people, period, you know, and to share their foibles and failures with other members. Two, there's no leader of the group. There's no one in the group that has authority over what's right and what's wrong. Yeah, there's somebody who's calling it to order and stuff, but that's it. There's no, you know, and, you know, that's the exact structure. And three, that nobody tells outside the group that they're a member of this group and all this stuff. You know, it's anonymous. You know, and he has a whole bunch of other conditions that he puts in there as guidelines, you know, suggestions for, you know, how the meeting should. Once you say that these are rules and not suggestions, you've invited ego into the room. And that's what they call in Alcoholics Anonymous Rule 62, which is don't take yourself so damn seriously. There were many times in early AA where they had these groups that they made up to make them more efficient, and all that happened was egos got involved about what would be the most efficient way, what's working, what's not working, what's good, what's not good, instead of just leaving everything up to a group conscience, which is a simple vote, majority vote, you know, and you know, no, it was, it should be this way, it should be that way, it should be the other way. And therefore, these things have to be suggestions, even by the P.S. Etzner, you know. So if you want this group to survive, because if you say, no, the Rebbe can do it because he's the Rebbe and nobody else, then guess what? When he dies, somebody else is going to be Mamala Mukum. Guess what? It's going to be one of us, won't it? You know, it's just asking for trouble. So the culture of the meetings is of complete equality. Complete simplicity, where there's nothing is valued but honesty, you know, not greatness, you know, but just honesty. And the crosstalk is avoided. Meetings, SA meetings, AA, NA, typically don't have crosstalk, meaning we don't talk across each other. In other words, you share something, I don't interrupt you, for sure. And number two, I don't comment directly on anything you said. Like if you say, you know, my wife is such a jerk, she did this, she did that, I can't stand it, you know, and I need God to help me with my resentment, and I want to stay sober, da-da-da-da-da. Oh, it was wrong for you to say my wife is a jerk, blaming your wife and this and that. That's not exactly working the steps right. That's not taking responsibility for your part of it. That's not this. That's not that. It's also Lashon Hara. It's also not nice, you know, and it's not good for you. And it's pointing a finger, and four others or three at least others are pointing it, you know, back at yourself. So what's going on here? So nobody else can comment in the meeting itself that, you know, that what you said was wrong. What you said is not good. Oh, yeah, but you're letting him go on with his understanding that's mistaken. Well, guess what? Our meetings are based on attraction, not promotion. Our fellowship in general is based on attraction, not promotion. We don't promote ourselves. We don't argue. We simply state what we believe about ourselves, not about you, our opinion about you. We state our opinion about ourselves very openly. You know, we share what's going on with us, you know, openly, with each other, so that whoever wants my experience will take it, you know. Guard Your Eyes, by definition, has to promote itself. They put ads all over the place. When's the last time you saw an ad for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? They don't put out ads. You know, Mothers Against Drunk Driving might say, join AA if you have a problem, you know what I mean? But AA gets no money from Mothers Against Drunk Driving. That's the seventh tradition. We don't accept outside donations, because if we do, we're going to be under the auspices of another organization, and our organization will be destroyed, which is why Volozhin closed. Volozhin closed because the Nitziv basically decided that once the Russian government has power over the curriculum, we're screwed. You know, you can't play with the government now. You can't do that. You have to close the yeshiva. Better it should be closed than krum. And that's what he did. And that's the same exact idea over here. You can't get involved in outside issues. That's another tradition. Look in the 12 traditions. You'll understand exactly how meanings work. Because the 12 traditions are the suggestions that we have accepted on ourselves as 12-step people for how our meetings work and how the culture of recovery works in a, as a group, you know. And when a person uses these traditions, then you work in your family on a different basis, because you start to work that way within your family and within your marriage and with everybody around you, you know. That doesn't mean to say that a father or a mother doesn't have a specific role with a child, you know, et cetera, that, you know, or a teacher doesn't have authority in the classroom. The steps aren't rules. They're suggestions of how to work in a group, you know. That's all. Some don't apply in certain situations. That's understood. But anyhow, you know, I certainly would not run a tzedakah organization without promoting it. You have to promote it, because it's not about sharing, you know, what I've got. It's about supporting a specific person and a specific mission. It's a whole different ballgame. So the goal is different, and the tools are different. So, you know, anyhow. So, getting back to the point again about the meetings, this all explains how the culture of meetings actually works, and what it's about, and why they do these things. You know, I've had a number of people on Guard Your Eyes say to me, "Okay, I want to go to a meeting, but I want it to be a private meeting. Can you just get three other guys that you know in Bar Park, you know, and, you know, or Crown Heights, get three other guys who you know in Crown Heights or Bar Park or Lakewood or, what, or you know, Baltimore or Chicago or, you know, name your area, you know. You get me three other guys who you know are good. They're safe. Oh, and they're from, too, you know. And, you know, not the goyim that go to the meeting. I want one of the safe guys, you know. So, and get them together. I would meet with them, you know. You know. So why is that not going to work? You know, for the same reason that this other scenario is not going to work. How about this? We get together a chevra of guys. Let's say there's a desperados group, you know, a meeting of the desperados, or Guard Your Eyes, oink. Guard Your Eyes used to have a group called OINK, O-I-N-K. I forget what it stands for, but it was created by a few guys who one or two are still on Guard Your Eyes to this very day in different capacities. I actually met some of them at, I don't know if it was an OINK meeting or officially or not, but I met a bunch of them about 10 years ago in Kiryat Sefer. We had a beautiful meeting there together of like seven or eight guys, I think it was, six or seven or eight guys. Some of them are still on Guard Your Eyes, you know, posting every now and then. So anyway, so you get together a group like this, and then you keep it closed, and you don't admit anybody new into the group. You know, because we're not comfortable. You know, now we have a chevra. The chevra works great. Why rock the boat? You know, don't allow anybody new in the group. You know? To the right. Yeah. Yeah, all the way down to the right. Yeah, no problem. Once you do that, both of those scenarios are based on selfishness. There's a conversion that happens somewhere in the middle of that whole thing, where in the beginning you were on your knees. In the beginning you came grateful that other people were willing to let you in. And now you don't want to let anybody else in because you found that safe place. You know, and you collude with the other members who, you know, who agreed to risk meeting you that first time, and the butterflies were in your stomachs, in each other's stomachs. Butterflies, and you agreed to meet together, and it was, and like, there was a certain uncomfortability there. It was, and yet you overcame it, that humility, that surrender, that my recovery is more important than anything, I have to take some risk, you know, of meeting these three other guys that I've been on the phone with for the past 2 years. Wow, what a big risk, you know. So, you know, and now I want to keep that door closed for anybody else who wants to experience what I got. Well, let them start their own group, you know. So anyway, 12 steps meetings understand that that's hypocrisy. And we understand that the one reason that we're clean now isn't because we have the strength of the group, et cetera, et cetera. It's because of that surrender that we first had when we first started, that new thing that we did when we first were like crawling in to the room, just crawled in. Will you take me? I need you. I need your help. Would you please accept me? I need your help. I'm the one who's coming for help. I'm asking you to please help me. That is where we get, that's the well, you know, the wellspring, the air from which everything we have and are going to ever have comes, you know, is Noveya. You know, by the way, in Brich Shmei, which is a tikkun for Zera Levatella, from addicts all know, because it's 130 words, can I get 130 words of other Marisha and the separated wives, Zera Levatella, blah, 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 blah. So fine. In there, my three favorite words are be'er, is be'ana rochit. In you, with, you know, you I trust. In you I trust. In God we trust. It's like on the dollar bill. In God we trust. You know, be anorachit. In you I you know, I trust, I hope, you know. I only pray to you, you know. Lo al bar lohin samichna v'lo al bar, you know. We don't have trust in Malachim or anybody else or any judge or any king or any this. It's only in you. Be anorachit. Lishmei kadishi akira, you know. Only in your, you know, only in you, God. Do I trust? And that those letters are Beis Aleph Resh, Be Anarachit, Be'er. It spells a well. That's my well. You know, I trust in you. So it's very easy to say, oh, I trust in God. It's God. I have no ego. I'm a nothing. Ich bin gurnish, da, da, da. But when it comes to proving that among people, all of a sudden I'm not a gurnish anymore. All of a sudden, no, 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 no. I'm not so comfortable about saying the truth about myself. You know, this is a lie. This is a lie within us. Until we can, you know, expose ourselves in a, you know, in this kind of a healthy way to another, to other safe people, we're still likely to be full of ourselves. We're still likely to be fooling ourselves that we're really exposing ourselves honestly in front of God. Because you know Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and I say this frequently, he said to his Talmidim, when before he died, he blessed them that they should take God as seriously as they take a shiksa standing on the next to them at the bus stop. You know, I want you to take God. I give you a blessing that you should take God as seriously as you take, some stranger standing at a bus stop watching you, where you won't do it because someone's watching you because they're real. That's the way I want you to take God seriously, you know, because you don't. And he said, Teda. When they said, that's it, ugh, that's such a low madrega. What about Yiras Shemayim and all the deep things in Yiras Shemayim? He said, no, Teda, know this. Adam over Avera of Omer Belibo, you sin, Adam. What is he saying, Adam? He's talking about them, but he doesn't say it in a nasty way, so he doesn't say you, but he's referring to them. And these are Tanoim he's talking to. He says, you, Adam, over Avera, you sin, Omer Belibo, and this man says in his heart, why does he sin? Because he says in his heart, Ubilvad Shelo Yirani Adam. As long as no other person sees me. You know? In other words, we don't take God so seriously as we think. And when the frum guy who's been frum for years and years and years comes and he says, you know, I have this problem. I've been masturbating, looking at pornography for, you know, all this stuff over and over and over for 15, 20 years. And, and you start talking about faith in God and trust in God and step, you know, these different steps that talk about awareness of God and surrender to God. And he says, what are you talking about God for? I'm a firm guy. He says, well, if you were so firm, then what were you masturbating for all those years?
Oh, well, I had a Yetzirah. Great excuse. Is God serious? Is God real? If somebody would have been watching you, if a stranger would have been watching you, would you have stopped immediately and slammed your computer shut? Oh, yeah, of course. Well, you don't take God nearly as seriously as you take even a total stranger, certainly a family member or a friend. Then you would, like, want to die if they saw you doing this stuff. You know, a total stranger, you'd also stop. You don't take God that seriously. The excuse of the Yetzirah is trash. Trash. Now,
can
for
I ask
someone
a question?
Who sins, excuse me for a second. For someone who sins once in a while, that's a sin. That's not an addiction. Such a thing, certainly the Yetzirah is definitely a very relevant factor. Definitely. Definitely. But for a person who's in a pattern, the Yetzirah has absolutely no relevance to this discussion. None. The person simply has graduated from taking God seriously. You know? And that's the problem. That's the problem that addicts of all types have. Heroin also. Alcohol. It's the same thing. Why do they all hide their drinking later on in the disease? Why is the drinking hidden? Why are bottles hidden? Why is the drinking done and you don't even notice it? What, he's drinking? You know, even the family doesn't even notice it until they're drunk later, you know? Why? Why are they hiding? You know? Anyway, yeah, go ahead. You want to ask a question?
Yes, yes. Thank you very much.
Please.
The truth is that if a Kadosh Baruch Hu is very real and very serious, after all, we don't behave towards a Kadosh Baruch Hu the way we behave towards a human being. We go to toilet. I'm not going to toilet in front of other human beings. I'm having a shower.
Yes. I've spoken about this many, many times. This is not a question. Because I understand what you're saying, but I've spoken about this many times. The fact is that I do these things because there's no embarrassment in front of him, because I know that bodily functions are not inherently embarrassing. There's nothing evil about body functions. Yes, I wouldn't want to vomit, let's say. I would throw up in front of God. I would go to the bathroom and have a bowel movement in front of God because God's here. Right, but in front of another person, I wouldn't do that. Well, that's because there's nothing immoral about a bowel movement. The reason that I don't want to do these things in front of other people, besides sneeze, the reason from shame, from embarrassment, that if, let's say you had, I mean, were you here earlier on the call when I was talking about choking and throwing up? A person who feels that they're about to vomit, if let's say you're at a simcha, and you come down with a stomach virus, sometimes rather suddenly a person feels they have maybe 5 seconds of warning and they have to vomit right there. Mm-hmm. And you vomit at the table. You're wearing a suit, you know, you're standing straight like we like to stand in public to look okay, you know, and good. You have a face, you know, of a Talmid Chacham, you have a face of a Yid, nice, and there's a certain presentation. A person should hold himself in a respectable way. That's normal. And then you have to vomit. It's very unrespectable. There's nothing evil about it. There's nothing shameful. There's no avera. There's no immoral. There's no disrespect. There's no disrespect to anybody else there. If they had a stomach virus, they wouldn't know it. They found out 5 seconds ago, they started feeling vomit. They started to deny, vomit, I'm not going to throw up. I just feel a little nauseous. I'm sure it'll go away. And then suddenly another wave comes, and the person says, oh, I feel like I might vomit. And I see the bathroom is on the other side of the wedding hall. I have to walk. And the person starts to walk across the wedding hall, does he take the shortest way across the dance floor where he might vomit right in the middle of the dance floor? There's no one dancing. They're eating dinner. He can walk straight across to the bathroom. No, he walks again along the wall on the outside where there won't be everybody watching me in case I throw up, because he knows this is going to be very embarrassing. What's so bad about throwing up? Nothing. There's nothing embarrassing. There's nothing evil about it. Why do you do that? Why would you, the Rosh Hashiva, your friend, your wife, your cousin, everybody do that? Only a child wouldn't do it. A child would walk across the floor to go to the bathroom, vomit in the middle of the floor, because a child doesn't have as big an ego.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're embarrassed and that's the point, we're embarrassed of bodily functions that we're powerless over. That's alcoholism, sexaholism, that's the disease. When I'm powerless over it and I do things that are against what I really judge to be good because I took the drug in my body 2 days ago and now I can't get it out, I don't know how to surrender yet. So the only way I know how to get this drug out of my system, the porn I watched, puts me on a. Once I watch the porn, I get put on a cycle, on a process that will have to end up with sex or masturbation, which is sex with myself. It will have to end up with this behavior, and the acting out cycle has started. And I go and go. It might take a day. It might take an hour. It might take a week. It might take 2 months, but it's going to end up that way. If I look at porn, if I take in my drink now, I have set in motion a process. And so it's a bodily function. I'm powerless over it. That's what powerless means. Powerless does not mean, for the thousandth time, powerless. I'm powerless over it does not mean I'm not responsible. That I'm not powerless. I'm not responsible. So there's no schar v'oyne. There's no this. There's no that. It's a disease. It's not immoral. It's a disease. It's a disease. No, you are responsible. 100% responsible. Maybe not 100%. Maybe it's 90%. I don't know. Adam muad la'olam. You are 100% for sure. It's true that the person's responsible. Having an addiction doesn't take away responsibility from me. It just changes the nature of the problem into something that I'm not getting the help I need, and I'm 100% responsible for not getting the help I need. Because the reason you and I don't get the help we need is only one reason. Well, there's two reasons. One, we want to keep acting out because it's sweet. Porn is delicious. If you have it as a habit, then you know it's delicious. That's one reason. We don't want to give it up. And number two, even when we want to give it up, we have too much of an ego. We don't want to admit our problem. And we start to equate it to going to the bathroom and making other excuses for why I wouldn't do this in public. I'm not saying the way you're saying it. I'm saying like the other way, where someone would say, well, this is an embarrassing thing. I have to say it. I have to tell other people. It's too embarrassing. I shouldn't have to subject myself to such shame. It's posnished, you know. That's the other way of looking at it, you know. And therefore, we don't get the help we want. And we sacrifice our reputation, our family, our neshama, our health, our money, eventually, you know, and sometimes our lives.
Yeah, thank you.
I, you're welcome. I've met quite a few people who have killed themselves, you know, in addiction, including sex addiction. So it's a problem. So getting back to the meetings is literally the only salvation for a person. For a person who needs this stuff, the meetings is the only salvation for them. If they want to get this self-honesty, if they want to get past this stuff, this is the way to do it. Therapy can also help a person instead of meetings. There are some people who, they don't need meetings, they need therapy because they need something else. You know? 12 steps is the only answer for this, for that, for the other thing. But it's not the only answer for everybody. Not every addict needs 12 steps recovery. Not every addict needs meetings. There are some people who are addicts who get better with other tools. There are some people who are addicts who get better without meetings, just getting frummer, keeping Torah mitzvahs better, and learning Musar Sfarim. Yes, 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 yes. There are some. I just haven't met many. I haven't met any, I think. Except I bet I have to believe that there are. Do I know them personally? No, I don't. But there are. I have to believe that because I'm not a closed-minded jackass. And I refuse to be one. I refuse to become a Hare Krishna, you know. I just refuse to be, a cult member, that this is the only thing that works and everybody has to do it. But if you want these things, if you want the self-honesty, if you want the ego shedding and the shame shedding, meetings is the way to do it. I don't know any other way. If that's what you want, if you want the therapy and fixing the way you think and da, da 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 specifically, and that's all you're interested in, so then do the therapy. Do the therapy. Isn't there hate? Maybe that's all you need. I don't know. You know? I don't know. You know? Many guys go to 12 steps and therapy. Many guys go to therapy and then the therapist sends them to the 12 steps, like in my case. You know? So there's a lot of flexibility here, you know? Unfortunately, and I know, I don't know who's listening to this recording and I don't know who's on the call anymore, But you know, the only people who I know who make a big stink about this business are either people who are incredibly closed-minded because they have the Maslow disorder. Abraham Maslow said, to the man who only has a hammer in his tool chest, every problem appears to be a nail. He thinks every problem he sees, that's a nail. Oh, get the hammer, you know, because he doesn't have a screwdriver. He doesn't have anything else in his tool chest. What works for me has to work for you, you know. That's, and you find this in Judaism. You find groups in Judaism. You find groups in Yiddishkeit who try to convert everybody to be like them, you know. I actually met a guy like that from a certain group who said to me that there's two kinds of Jews, Jews like us and Jews who are going to be like us. That's it. And I'm thinking to myself, something's wrong with that picture, you know. Something's arrogant about that. There's something arrogant about that, from a 12-step perspective at least. You know, from my perspective at least. I don't know. Maybe I'm speaking for 12 steps and I shouldn't. I'm certainly not speaking for SA. This is not an SA call. This is a guard your eyes call. But anyway, to you know, that's not my belief set. But the people who but there's one guy in particular who I know who constantly accuses me of that, you know, and or not constantly, who black and white thinking. There's a guy who I know who seems to say that. He seems to believe that about me, and he seems to say that as a devapushit and kind of chuckles. And it's like, you know, why do you need to put me in a box? I'll be put in a box after 120. You know, don't put me in a box now, you know. Why do you have to put me in a box? Why does it comfort you so to put me in a box? But anyway, I don't want to put other people in a box, you know. Maybe I'm wrong about this guy. Maybe I'm putting him in a box. You understand? Maybe I'm the one who's putting him in a box, and it's not him at all. And this is something that I'm mistaken about completely, you know. Maybe it is. Maybe I'm wrong. So you know, but this business of having to categorize other people as, oh, he believes in this and he believes in that, that's not a great quality to have. It's not a helpful quality for me to have. And I'm sure it's not a helpful quality for him to have if he's got it, you know, or if any of us has got it. So what happens in the meetings, you know? We become equals. You know, a little bit of the ego is shed. We stop commenting on others like we know what to do, you know. And if I wouldn't be in recovery, I wouldn't have even realized that I might be wrong about this guy's opinion about me. And guess what? This guy probably hasn't thought about me in months. You know, I said hello to him once or twice. But, you know, he probably hasn't thought about me maybe in years. And maybe he's changed his mind about me. Maybe he doesn't care about me. Maybe the universe does not revolve around me. Just maybe. You know, that's recovery. How do I move on? How do I move on? Gotta let go. Gotta let go. That's the only tool I have, is let go. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, means, afilu hu notelos nafshecha, v'chol levavcha, v'chol nafshecha, v'chol meodecha. With everything, surrender it all. Just give it all up. God's the only act in town. The world revolves around God, not around me. You know? So that's what this stuff is leading to. That's what the meetings are leading to. You know? Open-minded acceptance of other people. You know? If somebody has a complaint over the derech that somebody's doing, so then discuss it with them. Get clear what the truth is. You know? Discuss it. You know? And that's fine if you have a problem. You know? But otherwise, live and let live. You know? Let this person, you know, I'm okay, you know. Thank God I'm okay. You know, I want to use the point of the lack of acceptance of other people's stuff as an illustration point. That's all, you know. A person who really loves other people will see other people and will say, you know, maybe he disagrees with the way I do things. Maybe he has some misimpressions about me. But guess what? That's not what it's all about. Okay?
that's just not what this is all about. That's not why I was born. That's not why I was brought here and made, for people to like me, for people to agree with me, for people to respect me. That's not why I was created in this world, you know. And the meetings are a tremendous help at letting go of that need, you know. The other thing is that the way that meetings work, therefore, is that the steps are not worked in a meeting, because you can't go through a personal experience, a personal spiritual experience, very easily in a group setting, you know, as part of a group. That just does not work. There's no way that you can actually work the steps together with a bunch of other people on a time clock. You know this from Yiddishkeit. You know, the time of tshuva is here. The time of simcha is here. The time of cheres is here. The zman of this is here. There's all these seasons for this season, for that season, for the other thing. How well has that been working for you, friends? You know, has it been working for you? Well, some people will say, it's been working for me great, because I love living in La La Land. I love pretending that I'm doing this and doing that and doing the other thing. Well, but guess what? When your child, God forbid, is ill, and you fall onto your knees and you pray to the Rabbanu Shalom, and then you start doing tshuva, and your business is thing failing, and you start doing a real tshuva mi'umka deliba, that's your personal Yom Kippur. Like we have personal Purims, you had your personal Rosh Hashanah, you had your personal Yom Kippur, you had your personal, the person becomes, let's say you get married, let's say you have a child, let's say you get a raise, let's say you're Ola L'Gedula. Like the Gemara says, Mochlin La Kol Avanosav, Ola L'Gedula, that's your personal, you know, getting married, Yom Kippur, etc. Everything changes for you. That's your new lease on life. That's your new experience. Your cheres. There's a personal cheres that happens to a person if he's fortunate and has such an experience. You know? And that's the true thing. The holiday is a chance to experience the mida. When does it really happen in your life? For everybody it's different. Of course. For everybody it's different. And like Reb Tzvi Meyer explains, these Yomim Tovim are times that are misugal to gain these things. They're times that are misugal to gain these nudos, you know, to gain these things. It's not a boat that you're going to miss. If you don't get it now, you're not going to get it. That's not the point. You can get it all the time. All these nudos you can get all the time. You know? You know, Abraham is the nida. The nida, you know, Pesach is the holiday of Abraham Avinu. That's the holiday. That's Abraham Avinu. And you know, it's Emuna. That's the Nichla de Mehemnusa. That's Abraham Avinu's holiday. It's the holiday of Chesed. That's why the Bnei Yisrael says that it's called Shabbos. You know, Mimachos Shabbos. It's because it's the day of Chesed. It's a day when the midos aren't deserved. Hashem just picks you up. It's complete Isarusa de la'ela. And it's a complete gift. That's Avraham Avinu. It's about chesed, chesed, chesed. Chesed, you can't possibly be zochet a chesed. You can't deserve chesed. Chesed is chesed. Once you deserve it, it's din. It's not chesed. So Avraham Avinu's holiday is Pesach. But we learn about Avraham Avinu all year long. We learn about him way back in, before Hanukkah time, you know, after Sukkot, you know. So, between Sukkot and Hanukkah, we're learning about Avraham Avinu, and you're working on the midos of Avraham. Why? It's not yet Pesach. Why are you doing that? Because it's all a mishmash. It's all over the place. All the stuff is all over the place. You know? There's a time that's misugal for it, obviously. You know? So this is your own personal chance to get all this stuff. That's working the steps. The meeting won't work for that. The meeting won't create. Even if you work the steps in a meeting workshop that goes through the steps, it won't create the step experience. That's one-on-one, one addict helping another. That's what a sponsor is for. Sponsor is for working the steps. And a sponsor is not for keeping you sober. Sponsor is for working the steps. If you have an honest relationship with a sponsor, you'll be able to... If you have an honest relationship with your sponsor, then you'll be able to use your sponsor, obviously, and that relationship will help you stay sober. because it will help you with the self-honesty that you need to have in order to stay sober. You know? Because it's hard to stay sober. It's hard to surrender lust. It's hard to do those things. We don't know how to do it at all when we come here. We have no clue. We're not just powerless, we're clueless. So the sponsor is one of those people that will help you and me learn how to surrender these things. You know, what does surrender mean? You know, what does powerless really mean? Why is that good for me to admit I'm powerless? How does that help me? Doesn't that make me even weaker? Isn't powerlessness weakness? You know, which is what I just defined it's not before. But you know, what's going on? You know, how did what do these things mean? That's what a sponsor does. Sponsor will share his recovery with the sponsee. The meeting is functions, and that's for working the steps. The meetings are an entirely different purpose. The meetings are creating an environment where all this stuff can just live. It's creating an environment where this stuff lives. It's alive. It's a community where people work steps, where people are sober, where people make their prime focus in life working on these steps and being sober and working on these steps, you know, working, putting these steps into action. And therefore, in meetings, we do two things. We get current. We say what's going on with ourselves in a physically and spiritually. You know, people try to get current in their shares, what's going on. And number two, application. We share how we have applied the steps in our daily lives for ourselves. We don't give shiurim in a meeting of how to apply the steps. We share how we apply the steps in our daily lives in meetings. And we get current, you know. And if you have a choice between one and the other, I would choose getting current. But anyway, and many, many others do choose that, and that's what they do. So kind of wrapping it up, so the point of the meetings, is to have a place where people can come in, sit down, and say, you know, I'm a sexaholic too. You know? And then you turn, and then the guy next to you says, so am I. That's why I'm here. Hi. And he holds out a hand. You shake his hand. You know, oh, hi. I never shook the hand of another person who admitted they were a sexaholic before. That's cool. Thank you. It's a whole different culture. It's a whole different world. Where everybody else you are, everybody shakes each other's hand because they don't know the truth about each other. You know, because they know the things that you want them to know about you, you know, and you showcase them, which is fine. You're allowed to toot your own horn. There's nothing evil about that. Not to lie, but to, you know, not to get any of the dust, but, you know, there's nothing wrong with being okay, not being okay, but, you know, being a good guy with good qualities, you know, openly, there's nothing evil about that, but what about all the stuff that I'm doing that's crazy and how I'm destroying my life because I'm an addict and the stuff that I'm just been putting on the back burner? My back burner has pots, 100 pots on it already. What's going on here? I'm burning the candle at both ends. I'm a fool. His alalti b'mitzrayim. I am paro, like I said in the talk about Pesach, which is so, so important to me. So important to me. I am paro. I'm the addict. I'm not the Bnei Yisrael being liberated from the addiction, blah, 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 from Mitzrayim, blah, blah, blah. That's not the experience. It's paro, addicted to his Jews, getting the crap beaten out of them over years and still running into the Yom Tov and surviving and then coming around and realizing, oh, my God. And that's what Hashem says in the Torah. Why did he do the Makos? Not for the Jews. It doesn't say that in the Torah. It says precisely the opposite. Throughout the Torah, over and over and over, he says, I'm doing these makos so that Mitzrayim will know, so that Paro will know, to help Paro, to help Mitzrayim. That's why I'm doing these things. I'm helping them suffer. Yore chatoim baderech. I am throwing forcibly like an arrow, like a rock. Yore chatoim baderech. I'm throwing them down hard onto the proper path because they won't go any other way. And finally Paro comes around, you know? Finally Paro comes around. That's the addict finally getting surrender. Surrender, I surrender, I give you up, go. I let you go. I let you go. Finally, I can let you go because I've lost enough. Do you have to lose everything? No, only Paro has to lose everything. Most addicts don't have to lose everything. You go to an AA meeting or an SA meeting, you'll meet some addicts who've lost everything, and you'll meet some addicts who have practically lost nothing. They've just suffered horribly inside. You know, there's one guy on the Desperados who's sharing, he hardly lost anything, but, you know, and his acting out wasn't so bad. It was just masturbation and pornography, you know, and it was driving him crazy. He suffered at least as much as the guys who are doing prostitutes and all this other stuff, you know. And, you know, and there's some of those guys on let's say, you know, this is the Desperados call, and the same thing is in SA meetings and SLAA and SAA and all the other 12-step meetings about, you know, all this stuff. It's the same thing. It's people of different levels, not of addiction, of people of different levels of behavior, and they're addicts. They're the same addict. The addict is the same. The addiction is the same. The behaviors that he does, the behaviors that I do, one might be much more technically worse than the other, but the suffering inside all had to come to the point, the same point, where I was ready to give it up. That's the only reason I came to recovery, is because I was finally ready to give it up because I suffered enough. That's all.
That's what I owe it all to, suffering enough.
You know, enough pain. I had enough. I said, oh, you know, I give up. You're the boss of me. I give up now. Who can help me out? It's got to be a higher power. It's got to be. First higher power I found was other sexaholics in a group. That was my first higher power, because I didn't know how God could save me from this, because I had been from for 20 years acting out, and God hadn't saved me from this, so what am I going to do? And they taught me how to use God. They taught me how to be honest. They taught me I never used God before because I was never honest. They taught me that honesty comes from self-honesty, and honesty with God comes from one thing, being honest with other real-life people. That's the only way. Period. Now, as far as a therapist goes, there is a certain aspect where a therapist is weaker than a 12-step group. And that's from the simple reason that a frum woman can go to a male gynecologist. Why? Why? How can she do that? You know? Well, the answer is very simple. He's just a doctor, and she's a piece of meat on the table. There's nothing else there. You know? And she knows it, and he knows it, and that's it. So it's the same thing with a psychologist, psychiatrist. You can be analyzed, you know, till you turn blue and your head falls off. You know, it might not help you at all. It might not help you an iota. But when you walk in the room and there's your brother there, there's your father there, there's your chavrusa there, there's, you know, 20 other men who you don't know who are just, you know, also married with children. Some are goyim, some are yidden, or whatever. There's some doctors, some lawyers, some accountants, some colo guys, a rush colo sitting there, you know, a psychologist sitting there, and they're all sexaholics. And they're all sitting there telling the truth about themselves, telling the truth about their lives, talking about their resentments, talking about their joys in their life, the fact that they had a kid and that they're sober for the first time and this and that. And they're just being honest and open with no shame, with no self-disgust. Just open and honest. It's a first-time experience for that. That changes everything. Everything changes when a person comes to that kind of a state. And, you know, it becomes much easier to stay sober instead of just getting sober. I've gotten sober hundreds of times. I've quit hundreds of times. Hundreds of times I've quit. I'm an expert at quitting, you know. I stopped quitting, basically. When I came to recovery, I stopped quitting. You know, I started being sober. Sobriety was always my problem, not the acting out. Being sober was the thing I couldn't tolerate. You know? Anyhow, so recovery changes that. The steps change that. The fellowship changes that completely. That's the experience of the recovery, of the fellowship. And finally, meetings are private. That's called anonymous. Guard Your Eyes is secret. That's not anonymous. It's secret. It's relying on fake. Since I don't have to tell you who I am or anything about me, and you can't guess because I'm not going to put any personal information here at all. And Taka, I shouldn't put personal information on Guard Your Eyes. It's a highly dangerous place for me to put personal information. I'm going to lose my job, and my standing in the community is going to be destroyed because it's a public open forum where plenty of non-addicts are, plenty of curious people are, plenty of addicts who are totally not yet in recovery at all are in it. They're very dangerous to open up about my personal life on Guard Your Eyes. Very dangerous. You should never do that. But if, you know, if your name is Yekusiel Chaim, you should certainly not be writing Yekusiel Chaim on the forum. If your name is Shmuel, why not? There's 4 billion Shmuels running around, you know? Well, if you say your name, Shmuel, and you say that you live in, you know, Peekskill or something, so then guess what? Now maybe it's a problem, you know? If you say your name is Shmuel and your wife just had a baby yesterday, and, you know, then maybe that's a problem. You can't pair up, you can't triangulate yourself into identity. You know, that's going to be a problem. You must not do that on Guard Your Eyes. It's not a safe place. The only thing safe about Guard Your Eyes is that it's so fake in terms of the identity, is so fake that you're safe because you're hidden. That's what makes Guard Your Eyes the beautiful tool that it is. People who have no place else to go, no place else to go, can come to Guard Your Eyes because nobody's really there. They're not really there, and no one else is really there because no one's using their real name. So, therefore, there's no honesty to other people that leads to self-honesty because there's no other real people. And until a person understands that, they can't even approach what I'm talking about. Until a person understands that, when people say to me, "What do you mean there's no real people there?" That, the, you know, Gingerbread Man is a real person behind the computer. He's a real person behind. No, no, no. You don't understand. Think it over again and then come back. Think it over. Think it over. Why are you okay doing that? But you're a meeting, or actually meeting someone else in my neighborhood. You know, there's one guy who I know. I set him up with somebody real. He was, "Yes, I'm ready. I want that. I want that." When I set him up, when it came time to do it, he was like, "I need to know about the guy. I'm not so comfortable." And then eventually the whole thing was tabled when the time came. Why? 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 Well, cheshbon, that cheshbon. No, no, no. The truth, the simple truth is that when it comes to the time to doing it, I can talk about fear of dogs all day long. But when a dog pops into the thing and there's really a dog there in front of me in the street, a loose dog, suddenly the fear is overwhelming and so real. Now I remember it. Discussing it and categorizing it is all BS. It's all just talk, intellectualizing. When the real thing happens, the experience is the reality. You know, realness is real. And you know it when you see it. And fake names is not real. If I have to use a fake name, that means that I don't trust you. If I don't trust you, I'm not real with you. I don't trust you. I'm being, you know. And by the way, the reality of myself is totally different based on that. Because when I say to you, just the other day, I was at a meeting where a pastor admitted, you know, his sexual acting out for decades, sexual acting out for a long time, a decade, I think it was, about 10 years, you know, of real serious acting out as an active pastor of a decent sized church, you know, And the guy is admitting his sexual acting out and this and that over these years. And that's a different kind of acting out than a 14-year-old kid who masturbates a couple of times a week. That's a little different now. A little pornography, and a 12-year-old boy looks at pornography. That's a little different. It's very different, actually. A guy who's married with children, who's doing this stuff and meeting other women or other men in bathrooms or this or that, that's very different than, somebody else doing it who's not married with children doing it. It's not just morally different. It's not the pshat that it's worse, it's better, it's more disgusting. The pshat is that he's living a lie as opposed to choosing a lifestyle, and this is his lifestyle. He's having sex with these people, and that's his lifestyle. But now he's got two lifestyles. He's got a frum lifestyle, he's giving shiurim, and he sits at his table and he gives a shiur and being a father every day at the dinner table to his wife and children. In action, he's giving a shiur. He's being another person. And now he's got this other life where he's doing these opposite things. Opposite. That's a totally different experience. That's a totally different reality than just a person who acts out. So on Guard Your Eyes, all you're safe telling anybody about and all you should tell anybody about is you're acting out. You can't tell them, I'm acting out, doing this, that, and the other thing, and you say what you're doing. I'm acting out, going to, I'm masturbating myself, looking at this type, pornography, and violent pornography, and this, and I've been to this kind of a sex worker, and that kind of a sex worker, and I do these things, and then, and I'm married, with so many children, and I do this for a job, and I do that, you don't know what part of the positive side of your life, of the outside, the normal appearing side of your life that you're going to expose is going to identify yourself in public. You must not share that stuff. It is a terrible mistake to make. Guard Your Eyes is an open forum, an open website. It is not safe for that reason, and you should not be sharing that stuff. But when you come into a community of other people like you, who have this problem, who are open and ready to admit this stuff, guess what? Suddenly you found a safe place. You found a safe haven. You can do this stuff. And the raya that it is safe is because these meetings have existed now for many, many years in the frumest and tightest communities. And every guy I speak to is, you don't know what it's like. In my community, everybody knows about it. Everybody else is... it's like, well, and I tell them, guess what? There's been a meeting, there's been 15 meetings in your area going on for the past 15 years. Oh, 15 meetings a week. And there's 50 guys going to each one of those meetings sometimes. And he goes, what? Well, if it wasn't safe, how long do you think those meetings would last? 2 days? Then nobody would come. Right? So there's a safe culture there. Because it's the opposite of what Guard Your Eyes is, the opposite. Instead of it being a place that's unsafe, because Guard Your Eyes is unsafe, and you should not be sharing personal details of the positive, open side of your life, the healthy side, which is essential to give context to the sick side, you can't expose yourself like that. You can't identify yourself like that. It's an open environment, and it's unsafe. SA meetings, SLAA, SAA, these different fellowships, the 12-step fellowships, they're closed meetings. They're not open meetings. They're only for other addicts. And the fact that you don't go is the same reason that other people don't go, because the only people who go are people who are willing to go. And if you're willing to go, you're dang serious. So that's the safest we can make it. I'm sorry. It's the safest we can make it. The Desperados call, like I said before, I'm catering to a group of other, it's for men, it's a men's call. It's a Guard Your Eyes call, not an SA or SAA or any other 12-step group call, but it's just a group of guys who are not willing to do the meetings thing. So this is it's for the guys among them who are ill, like myself, who are ill, so then it will help them graduate from it to meetings. For those who are not ill, going through the steps as best we can, in a limited way, but as best we can, even though we're a group, going through the first step, second step experience, those first two steps will help many people discover whether or not they are addicts. And quite a few people have said to me after a couple of months on the Desperados call, going through the first step with us and the second step with us, sharing their story, etc., a number of folks have said to me already that I've discovered, and they said it on the call, I've discovered that I'm not an addict. And what's the response we give them? Congratulations, we're so happy for you. Ein simcha kahataras hasfekos. You know? Now you know. And how do you know? Not by listening to a shiur, but by going through the first and second step process with us on the call, actively. If you go through it actively, you will discover one way or the other, most likely, you will discover whether or not you are indeed ill, as I am, you know. And you can be sober, thank God, as I am too. If you are, that's fine. And if you're not ill, so then what are you? You know, what help do you need? You know, just because you're not an addict doesn't mean you don't need help. You got a problem if you're on this call. You definitely have a problem if you're on this call. Question is, what do you do next? Is it have to be an addiction? No. You know? So, promotion is go, do this. You got to do this. That's promotion. Attraction is, this is what it is. I want to define it for you. You want it, take it. It's available. Take it if you want it. You know, that's attraction. You know, promotion is the opposite. We're engaged in attraction here, not promotion. You know, I don't know what's right for you, and I'm never going to tell you. You know, so that's the basis on which our group works, and that's the basis upon which all 12-step fellowships work, all of them. You know, there might be some members who don't understand the difference, and they try to promote instead of attract. You know, they push people to do things, you know, because they don't understand. But generally speaking, the culture is the other way around. It's attraction, not promotion. You know, and that's a beautiful thing. It disinvites the ego, and it helps a person grow up for a change. You know. Anyhow, sorry for the digressions today. Thanks for your patience. I hope I covered things. This is not an essay call, but if people want information on essay, then all they need to do is go online and look it up, Sexaholics Anonymous. Look up the website. It'll give you information, you know. And there'll be contact numbers. And if anybody here who listens to this recording wants meeting locations, or you want to talk about meetings, or you want to talk about the 12 steps, or a fellowship, or a Torah in the 12 steps, or your concerns and issues and whatever it is, or your own situation, you can email me at wequithiding@gmail.com. Wequithiding, WEQUITHIDING, wequithiding@gmail.com. And I'll be very glad to discuss it with you if you like, or even just email it if you're more comfortable. Ma'am, the elevator's open over there. Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah, no problem. So the other thing I just want to say is that if people have concerns about family members and, you know, other you know, things like that, you can email me too, and I will try to send you to somebody who might be able to help you with that if I can. Hatzlacha, all the best.